This is the most beautiful subject in physics, and I hope at least you get some flavor of that in the course. I mean, general relativity is really the ultimate example of how the human mind, using mathematical reasoning, can understand the universe without even intending to. Okay? Einstein invented the theory of gravity to explain. His basic motivation was that he'd understood relativity, that you can't send signals faster than light, and yet Newton's theory of gravity seemed to be instantaneous, that two bodies, no matter how far apart they were, if you moved one, the force on the other would change instantly. So he knew that was incompatible with relativity. He had to make a relativistic theory of gravity, and the culmination of this was general relativity. And it turned out not just to describe the solar system and gravity on Earth and all kinds of other phenomena. So GPS, for example, now incorporates general relativistic corrections, and it's only accurate because of general relativity. But this theory also describes the whole universe, the expansion of the universe and the appearance of the cosmic microwave background the predictions are fundamentally predictions of general relativity. And Einstein never intended to describe that. Okay, so it's just an incredible example of how mathematical reasoning and good physics combine to give predictions beyond any expectation. So the outline of this course, if I can find it, and I do apologize if I'm somewhat disorganized today. Last week we were in Senegal, and we opened the new AIM Center there. So I know at least two of you will know what that means. Are the other AIM students here yet? They're still not yet. Okay, so that was very, very exciting. And AIM Senegal has 35 students from 18 different countries, including somebody from Somalia and Gabon and so on. And they're all basically like you, graduate students studying mathematical sciences. And in case you don't know it, Psi was designed as a copy of AIMS. So you're here because of AIMS. And I hope you get a chance to visit it someday. Okay, so the course, as far as I remember, the title is Introduction to General Relativity. And what the outline is as follows. In week one, we'll do a review of special relativity, and we'll discuss tensors and manifolds. Okay, so how many of you have taken a course in special relativity? Great, so the majority. Some of you have not, and I will be going fairly fast on special relativity. So please, tutors, take note. Those people who have not taken a course, you will need to do some catch-up reading this week. And it's very, very important because all the subsequent courses on quantum fields and so on will make heavy use of special relativity. But I will be going fairly quickly through it. General relativity is a generalization, obviously, of special relativity, where the key idea is that space-time is not a fixed entity. Space-time is malleable and curved, and the basic picture of space-time is that it is a manifold. So I'll be describing what that is and what tensors on manifolds are. So then, in week two, we will discuss curvature of manifolds and how space-time can be curved and the Einstein field equations. And then in week three, we'll discuss black holes and cosmology. And we'll do cosmology if there is time. Okay, so that's the outline of the course. This course really is foundational for much of the physics which you'll be taught throughout Psi. And as I mentioned, if I'm not clear or I mess it up, please don't be put off the subject, because it really is a wonderful, wonderful subject. There are two books which I'm recommending for the course. There's more or less an infinite number of books on general relativity. For this course, which is very introductory, I'm recommending two. One of them is this book by Sean Carroll. And that's certainly in the library. This is called Intro to GR, Space-Time and Geometry. And this is nice because it's actually online. So it's on the archive, and you can just find the lecture notes on the archive for free. And if you have trouble finding it, I'm sure one of the tutors will tell you where to find it. So you don't even need to buy anything. The second book, which I like, but some people, students in particular, don't seem to like very much, is this book called Introduction to GR. See, no, none of us are very original. And this is by L.P. Houston. And K.P. Todd. So these are two people in Roger Penrose's group in Oxford. And it's more mathematical, but very concrete. So you will not find lots of very abstract mathematics. It's very concrete, but it's quite advanced. And what I like about it is there's a lot in it, but it's very concise. And so you will, just by studying two pages in this book, you will learn quite a lot. Those are the two books I like. There are many others you should look at. For example, there's a book by Dirac, Paul Dirac, I think also called Introduction to General Relativity. And it's about 80 pages, a very short book, but absolutely beautiful. And completely from Dirac's point of view. Encourage you to look in the library. You'll find hundreds of books, but don't be put off by the volume of the books, because the subject is really, at heart, very simple, conceptually extremely simple. So let's begin straight away with discussing special relativity. So can everybody really see that properly? I'm just concerned. You're a bit at a steep angle. Is it okay? I can try and write the letters more stretched so that you... let's go back. Oh, thank you very much. That's great. That's great. Thanks a lot. Lovely. Oh, I even did it in color. Okay, so I'll give these handouts out. Too many to that row. I think I'm running out. Okay, whoops. Just one page each. If there's some left over, if you could pass them back at that side. Okay, so this is probably the most famous paper ever in theoretical physics. It proves that E equals mc squared. Okay, but it is 3 pages and there are no references. Okay, so we will be later in this lecture, or maybe early next lecture, we will review this argument as to why E equals mc squared, and I hope you'll appreciate it. So, special relativity, let's go back to the 1860s when the American Civil War was in full swing, and Stanley was exploring the interior of Africa. But something special was going on in Edinburgh, and that was James Clerk Maxwell trying to understand electricity and magnetism. And so Maxwell was a mathematical physicist, and he was trying to make a consistent story of electricity and magnetism. And he came up with the following equations, which I'm sure you've seen. This was Gauss's law, that the divergence of the electric field is the charge density divided by epsilon naught. And I'm going to use SI units. And div B equals 0. And then we have Faraday's law, curl E equals minus dB dt. And curl B is mu naught J. That was Ampere's law, showing how a current creates a magnetic field. This is the electromagnetic current. Sorry, electric current. That's the charge density. And mu naught is another constant. And then Maxwell corrected Ampere's equations with this term. So that was Maxwell correction. So the point is, these equations were known before Maxwell, but Maxwell realized they're actually mathematically inconsistent because of charge conservation. So you have rho dot equals minus div j. That guarantees that the total amount of electric charge is conserved. And what Maxwell showed, and it's not difficult, I'll leave it to you as an exercise, is that these equations with charge conservation are actually inconsistent unless you add this term. And this term is called Maxwell's displacement current. So in other words, a changing electric field really acts like a current in sourcing a magnetic field. So this equation is a combination of Ampere and Maxwell. Okay, so that was those were the equations for electricity and magnetism discovered by Maxwell. And what he noticed, having added this term, was that it is possible to consider a situation with no charge density and no current and still find some interesting solutions for electric and magnetic fields. And so what he found is that if rho equals j equals zero, there are still wave solutions. Okay, and so to see that, just calculate d2e by dt squared. So differentiate this equation d by dt, and then the db dt, replace it with this equation, and you'll get d2e by dt squared is minus 1 over mu naught epsilon naught curl of curl of E. And this is nothing but 1 over mu naught epsilon naught Laplacian on E. Using the following calculation. So to calculate the curl of a curl, use the fact that components of a curl are epsilon ijk dj ek. Okay, so this is curl E I. That's the ith component. So people happy with that formula? More or less? Okay, so that's the usual formula for a curl, just in Cartesian coordinates, x, y, z. And so if I have curl of curl, okay, what I do is calculate the first curl, so epsilon ijk, and now I need that del. So here I use the notation that del j equals d by dx j, and j is equal to 1, 2, 3. And so x1 equals x, x2 equals y, x3 equals z, for example. Just the usual Cartesian coordinates. And so here we have the first curl, epsilon ijk dk, dj times the kth component of this guy, which is epsilon KLM DLEM. Okay. And this epsilon here is the totally antisymmetric tensor. So this is 1 if IJK is an even permutation of 1, 2, 3, and minus 1 if ijk is an odd permutation of 1, 2, 3, and 0 otherwise. Okay? And to see if something's an even or an odd permutation, let me just give you 3, 1, 2, for example. Is that an odd or an even permutation of 1, 2, 3? Even? So even because if I flip two of them, the three goes in the middle, and I flip the three and the two, that's a second permutation, and so the three goes to the back, and so that's even. So an easy way to see if it's even or odd is just to write 1, 2, 3 and then connect the lines, and there are two crossings, so it's even. Okay, if there's a odd number of crossings, it's odd. Even number of crossings, it's even. Okay, so that's the definition of epsilon, and then there's the famous epsilon-epsilon identity, KLM. And the convention is whenever you see a repeated index, you have to sum over it. all of its values, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so that's, this is called the Einstein summation convention, actually. Summation convention. Okay, so K is summed over 1, 2, 3. And the epsilon-epsilon identity is just that this is equal to delta IL delta JM minus delta IM delta JL. And this is the case in three dimensions, but in higher dimensions, there are similar generalizations of this formula. Okay, so when you compute curl curl of E, you get this guy. And if I bring it over here, using the epsilon epsilon, I'm going to get delta IL, delta JM. So that will give me DI, DJ, delta IL, delta JM, DJ EJ. So that's the first term coming from here. And the second term will be minus delta I with M. So I with M gives me EI, and then delta JL gives me Laplacian. So I get DL DL EI. And yeah, that's right. So so this is equal to, now this is zero by Gauss because there's no charge density. And so this term is just minus Laplacian on E. And so the minus kills this minus sign and leaves me with the right-hand side. Okay, so one can deduce from Maxwell's equations with no charge or current density that the electric field obeys this equation, d2 dt squared E equals 1 over mu naught epsilon naught E, Laplacian squared times E. And of course, we also have that dV is zero by Gauss. And this equation is nothing but the wave equation. With a speed of propagation c squared, or c is equal to 1 over root mu naught epsilon naught. You see, when I look at this equation, here I've got d2 by dt squared, and here I've got d2 by dx squared. And so just on dimensional grounds, this coefficient must have dimensions of length over time squared, right? Because this is 1 over time squared, that is 1 over length squared. So I must have a length over time squared. And so that has to be a speed squared. And the speed, so that, in other words, this guy here is c squared, is 1 over, is c squared. And so the speed of propagation is 1 over mu naught epsilon naught. So now imagine you're Maxwell and you worked out this equation, okay? And you want to know, oh, what are these waves that I get out of electric and magnetic fields? Well, they have some speed, and what's that speed? So the experimental values of this epsilon naught and mu naught were known by Faraday and B.O. Savar and all these other people who'd measured them. So all he had to do is plug those numbers in here and figure out what the speed was. And it turns out the speed is 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. And that's the speed of light. And so as Feynman said in his book, Lectures on Physics, Volume 1, Feynman says, Maxwell could say when he was finished with his discovery, let there be electricity and magnetism, and there is light. Okay. So light, this most mysterious phenomenon, which has always been fundamental in physics, was suddenly understood as just a phenomenon of electricity and magnetism. So that, I think, is the greatest discovery ever made in physics. And there have been quite a few, but that was a really good one. Okay, so let's just see those solutions explicitly. So for example, let's say that the electric field is some function of x minus ct. Okay, so what I mean here is that the electric field is a vector, has three components, and each component is a function of one variable, and the variable is x minus ct. Okay, so I want to claim that that solves this equation. So to see that, just differentiate it. Okay, so d2e by dt squared will just be, you've got to differentiate this guy with respect to its argument. The argument is minus ct. When I differentiate with respect to t, I get the derivative of the function. Let's call it e prime of x minus ct times the derivative of the argument. So that'll be minus c. Sorry, that's differentiating once. Okay. And then differentiating twice, d2e by dt squared, I'm going to get another factor of minus c, and differentiate this function again. So plus c squared e double prime x minus ct. And on the left-hand side, I just do the same thing. So here, this Laplacian means d2 by dx squared plus d2 by dy squared plus d2 by dz squared. Well, my function's independent of y and z, so they give 0. And differentiating twice with respect to x just brings down, I'm just differentiating this guy with respect to x. The differential of the argument is just 1. So I get grad squared e is equal to e double prime x minus ct. And that's equal to what it should be. Okay, because this factor is c squared. So indeed, we've verified that that solves the equations. The only thing left to check is that we must impose that div e equals 0, and that means dEx by dx equals 0, because the only dependence is on x minus ct, so d by dy is 0, d by dz is 0. So there's no constraint on ey and ez, but the x component of the electric field must be independent of x. So a solution is e equals 0 in the x direction, and then ey of x minus ct. This can be any function of x minus ct and ez of x minus ct. And so basically, these are linearly polarized waves. And the picture is that if this is the x-axis and the y and the z and the y, then let's say we've got only this one non-zero. It can be any function at all of x minus ct, and it will just travel along at the speed of light. Okay, so we immediately see we have two independent polarizations, and you can have any waveform you like for the light. And the light is transverse. The electric and magnetic field, the electric field is transverse to the direction of propagation. Yeah.
The solution x direction is zero. Why is it constant?
Pardon? Why did I take ex to be zero?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. There's no need. I could have said ex is a constant, but that would mean just a background constant electric field. You see, so that's a legitimate solution, but it's just not physically very interesting. Okay, so if I'm sitting here in the room and somebody sends a light wave across it, well, they could also have a big charge plus on that side of the room and a big charge minus and a big electric field coming across. And the sum of those, the constant field and the traveling field would be a solution, but it's, you know, I'm just ignoring the constant field solution. In fact, it brings up a more general point. You see, Maxwell's equations going back here are linear. The way in which E, B, and B enter is linear. So you can just add any solution to any other solution. Okay? So if I give you some value of the source, charge, and the current, I can just add any other solution to the source-free equation, to the equations where this is zero, and just add them to E and B, and it's still a solution. So the only way to decide what the right solution is actually to impose some more conditions, some boundary conditions, to say, well, I know there isn't a constant electric field. Okay? So you always have to impose some boundary conditions. In solving the equations. And then I'll just leave it to you as an exercise to calculate B, the magnetic field. Okay, so if you look at these equations, curl E gives you dB dt, dt gives you curl B, and from that you can figure out what the magnetic field is. And it will turn out that if the electric field is polarized in one direction, the magnetic field is polarized in the perpendicular direction for linear polarization. And then, of course, there are more complicated solutions like circular polarization, where electric and magnetic fields rotate and so on. But all of these solutions are very straightforward to find. Your comment is relevant here. When I say calculate B, you can immediately see from the equations that a constant B is going to be a solution. So ignore the constant. Okay, calculate the kind of interesting part of B, the propagating part. Okay, so that is Maxwell's equations and their solutions. So I guess I need to continue over here. Now, when these equations were discovered, obviously physically this is really remarkable. But in fact, what was lying hidden in those equations was a symmetry which would only be understood 40 years later, okay, which is the symmetry of relativity. It all sits in those equations. And in fact, when Maxwell wrote these equations down, they didn't look anything like that, okay? He wrote them all out in components and was huge and complicated. And so this is quite condensed notation. But even with this notation, the symmetry of the equations wasn't obvious. And when that symmetry was understood, that is how relativity was discovered. It was discovered that these equations have a symmetry which is not compatible with Newton's laws of mechanics. Okay, so they cannot both be right. What Einstein and others realized in the beginning of the 20th century was that Newton's laws of motion and Maxwell's equations for electricity, magnetism, and light are incompatible. So one or other must be wrong, and Newton was wrong. Okay? So, and then actually, Maxwell's description of electricity and magnetism was the basis for Einstein's eventual theory of gravity. He really took this theory, so to say mathematically what it is, this is a field theory. Maxwell's theory of electricity and magnetism was the first field theory. Okay, and that's where the name field theory comes from, because these are fields, electric field, magnetic field, and so these are quantities which take a value at every point in space and at each instant of time, and that was the beginning of general relativity. General relativity is a field theory of gravity, and the Standard Model is a field theory of particles. And so this discovery of the first field theory made by Maxwell actually formed the basis of all of 20th century physics, and most of the course that you all do. Here. Okay, so in fact, Maxwell's equations possess, now I die. It's a design flaw, right? Somebody didn't think of that. An amazing symmetry. And so I'm going to write out this symmetry. And to see the symmetry, we're going to have to introduce a whole lot of notation. Okay, so I'm just going to ask for your patience. And once you're patient, you'll see that these equations can be written in a much more interesting, much simpler way. And when you write them in this simpler way, the symmetry is obvious. So let's see. Now, if I go down here, can you guys see at the back? That's okay? It's all good? Okay, I'll keep going. So first of all, so it's an amazing symmetry which links space and time. And so this symmetry implies, roughly speaking, that you can rotate space into time and time into space, and they really should be thought of together. But it took people a while to see that this is true. So how do you see it's true? Well, first of all, let us think about this wave equation. Okay, it's a simple thing, the wave equation. And let's try and write that in a simpler form. So the wave equation is constructed from d by dt and gradient, right? Which is a three vector, d by dx, d by dy, d by dz. So the question is, can we combine those two differential operators into a neater looking object? So the first thing to do is to invent this notation that x mu, so just as x is a three-component vector, x, y, z, okay, so x1 is x, x2 is y, x3 is z, let us invent a four-component vector, x mu, and this mu will run over values 0, 1, 2, 3. And the first value is going to be ct, and the next three values will be x, y, z. So why do I put the c there? Well, it's just by dimensions, okay? What I want here is a length. These threes are lengths. I don't want things of different dimension. So I just multiply t by c, and I get a quantity which is a length. So at least all of the components of this is now called a four vector, and at least all of its components have the same dimensions. Okay, so I can write this as x naught equals ct, x1 equals x, x2 equals y, x3 equals z. Now we can work out, for example, what is d by dx mu? So that's a four-component vector. Okay, mu takes values 0, 1, 2, 3. And if I work out its components, this is just 1 over c d by dt, because x naught is ct, so d by dx naught is just 1 over c d by dt. And gradient. And so that looks promising, because in the wave operator, what I have is d2 by dt squared, and then I have c squared grad squared. And so now we introduce another quantity. Let's call it eta. So this is a 4x4 matrix, and it'll be like this. So I just introduced that matrix. And then the wave equation is eta alpha beta d by dx alpha d by dx beta times something equals zero. Okay, so to see that, when I have this matrix multiplied by these two guys, I'm supposed to sum over all alphas from 1 to 4, and sum over all betas from 1 to 4. Pardon? Say again? Anything. The wave equation, you've got some function. Okay, I could put the electric field here if you like. But wave equation, by definition, is when I have some function of the x alphas, let's say, any function. So the wave equation means I have that operator acting on something being zero. And when we work this out, you see the only non-zero components of eta are ones where alpha and beta are both zero, or both x, both y, both z. And when they're both zero, I get minus 1 over c squared d2 dt squared, because I get this thing twice. And when they're both x, I get plus d2 dx squared. And then both y, I get that. And both z, I get that. Okay? But that is nothing but what I have over there multiplied by c squared, or divided by c squared, right? So this I could rewrite as 1 over c squared d2 by dt squared e minus grad squared, well, let's put a minus sign there, e equals 0. And so so that's the first thing to notice, is that if I introduce this eta matrix and this four-vector notation, I can actually rewrite the wave equation in a more compact form. Now, actually, what we do is introduce eta alpha beta with two, sorry, that's with two indices up. Introduce eta with two indices down. And that is equal to the inverse matrix of eta alpha beta. And it's also equal to the same thing. Okay? Because if I multiply this matrix by that matrix, all I get is ones down the diagonal. So we'll introduce that quantity. I won't motivate it anymore for the moment, just to say that it's another obvious matrix we could think about. Right. Now we're going to do something more clever. And I'll leave Maxwell's equations up there. In fact, I can do this, can't I? Now we do something clever. You see, combining space and time into four components is kind of obvious, right? Time is just another component. Let's have four vectors. But what do we do with the electric and magnetic fields? Okay, we would like to combine the electric, before we do the electric and magnetic fields, we can do the current. So similarly, let us define J alpha. So you see, I have current density. This is a three vector, and charge density. And I'd like to put them together into a four component vector. And again, the only thing we really have to worry about is that they have the same dimensions, okay? The quantity is going in here. So I put the charge density in there. Rho, okay? And let's put the current density in the other components, 1, 2, 3, charge density in the 0 component. And the reason I multiplied by C is I want everything to have the same dimensions. So current density means charge per unit area per unit time. Okay? That is electric charge per area per time. This is rho is charge per volume. And so if I multiply charge per volume by the speed is length over time, I'm going to get charge per area per time. Okay, so putting that factor in C there means these are now the same, at least they have the same dimensions. So we'll call that the current, this is called the electric current four vector. Okay, so I've succeeded in unifying space and time. as far as those objects are concerned. But what about the electric and magnetic fields? What about E and B? Okay, so they're each three quantities. How do I combine six quantities into something that looks like it lives in four dimensions? It can't be a four-dimensional vector, because that would have four components, okay? And I have six of these guys. How can I possibly put them together into something that looks like it lives in space-time? It has one time index and three space indices. Okay, so there are six independent components. So let's imagine we live in four dimensions, okay? What kind of objects do I have? Well, I might have a vector in four dimensions that has four components. No good. I might also have some matrix, okay? How many components of a matrix, a 4x4 matrix? 16. It's also not very good. What else could I do? I could symmetrize it. Very good. So I could say this, okay? So this notation means symmetrized. This is a half m alpha beta plus m beta alpha. So now if it's a symmetric matrix, so that m alpha beta equals the symmetrized version equals itself, then there are not 16 components, right? There are all the diagonal components. They're perfectly consistent with the symmetry. And then I can have some components up here, right? And then the components down here are just given by the ones up there, right? So these ones are not independent. So the number I have is 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 6. Okay, so 10 components. Wrong. So what else can I do? Anti-symmetric. Okay. So M alpha beta is 1 half M alpha beta minus M beta alpha. And if this equals M alpha beta, we say that it's anti-symmetric. And anti-symmetry means that the diagonal components have to be zero, because they're not compatible with symmetry. So the only allowed components are these ones, and those ones are just their negative. So there's six components, so clearly that's what we have to do. If we want a four-dimensional picture of physics, we have to combine electric and magnetic fields into a six-dimensional object, and that's called F. This is the field strength tensor and the way we do it, it has to be zero on the diagonals because it's anti-symmetric. And these components, so now it's just a matter of labeling. And we choose to name the components whatever we like. So let's just choose this. And of course, I make these choices because I want to derive these equations. So I'm just here labeling, i.e., F01 equals minus EX over C. And then these components, BZ minus BY BX. And on the other side, just the anti-symmetric versions, EX over C, EY over C, EZ over C, BZ here, minus BZ there, BY here, plus by there, bx there, minus bx here. And so another way to write this is that IE F0i, okay, so I'm going to use a notation that Greek indices go 0, 1, 2, 3, but Latin indices go only over space. Okay, so F0i is the 0th row and the ith column. So F01 is minus EX over C. And so you can see that this is just minus, F0i is minus EI over C. I is 1, 2, 3. And the space components, the space-space components of F, Fij, okay, they're equal to epsilon ijk bk. Again, I and j go over 1, 2, and 3. So F1, 2 means the first row, the 2 column, and over here I get 1, 2, 3, which B3 is BZ. Okay, so that is just a naming of all the components of F. And then the statement is the following, that the first and fourth of Maxwell's equations are just d alpha f alpha beta equals minus mu naught j beta. I need to define F with upstairs indices. And let me say a little bit about that. So this quantity eta can be used to raise or lower indices. Okay, so if I have, for example, eta alpha beta d beta, and I sum over the beta, well, that's just the matrix product of that eta alpha beta matrix over there with the minus 1 in the 0, 0 component, with the vector d beta, which is that quantity here. This is d mu. Okay, and so when I do that matrix times the vector, what I will get is a minus sign in this component, 1 over c minus 1 over c d by dt, and then grad. And I can call that d alpha. So that's the derivative operator, but with a raised index, because I've used eta to raise the index. And so similarly, if I have this f, I can define f with two raised indices. And f with two raised indices is equal to eta alpha mu eta beta nu f mu nu. Okay, so this was the definition of f with lowered indices. When I raise these indices, the only time I will get any change is where I have zeros here, right? But the only non-zero component of f is the one zero I. F zero zero is zero. The f zero I has is not zero. And basically from the zero times eta zero zero, I'm going to get a minus one, but the I index, here I will just get a unit matrix in the spatial direction. So I just flip the sign of the E terms. And so this will be 0, 0, 0, 0 plus EX over C plus EY over C plus EZ over C. And then the B terms don't get changed at all. That is BZ minus BY BX. And the same stuff with the minus sign. Okay, so that is what this F here means. And so all of this is notation. I haven't done anything at all. I'm just trying to write things in a more compact notation. But we've succeeded in combining two of Maxwell's equations into just one. Now, to check this is true, take the ith component of this equation. Okay, so the components are beta. Set beta equal to, let's set beta equals 0 to begin with. And so here I've got f alpha 0. Now, if that index is 0, the only non-zero components, that means that the row is 0. And the only non-zero components are the electric field components down here. Sorry, the column is zero, not the row. The only non-zero components are those with fi zero. So here I get di fi zero. And that's equal to, well, I have to take these three components, which are minus those ones. So I get minus div E over C, because there's a 1 over C factor there. And on the right-hand side, I have minus mu naught J0. And J0 is just rho C. So I have minus mu naught C rho. Okay, and now I use the fact that C squared is 1 over mu naught epsilon naught. So this means div E equals C squared mu naught rho equals 1 over epsilon naught rho. And that's Gauss's law. Beta equals I, the other equation. I think I'll just leave it to you as an exercise. Show you get Maxwell 4. Okay, so from that equation, all you get is these. It's a little more tricky because you get B terms and E terms. And just work out all the terms. So if beta equals I, I've got D naught F naught I plus DJ FJI. The FJI involves epsilon times B, right? From here, FJI is epsilon times B. And so this is going to give you a curl. Curl B is coming from here. This is going to be E dot. And so you're going to get E dot term, a curl B term, and then a mu naught J term, and just check that you get Maxwell's fourth equation. Right, how are we doing for time? What is the time? Where is the clock? No clock in the time room. That's a bit weird, isn't it? Time is relative. What is the time?
11:40.
And when did I start? 10:30. Okay, so I think I need to just summarize. Actually, how long are the lectures supposed to be?
Well,
it says 11:45.
It says what? We have lunch at 12.
You have lunch at 12. Okay. shall I go on for another 5 minutes? Is that all right? You're not exhausted? Okay. So I guess we only need to check the other Maxwell equations. So these are four equations here, right? Because the beta index could take 0 or I. So basically 0, 1, 2, 3. There are four equations here. And the four equations are this one, which is one equation, doesn't have any vector indices. And this one is three equations. So these together form that equation I wrote down here. Now the other equations, they're also four, right? Because there's one equation here and three equations there. So how do I combine them? Well, J doesn't come into it. The only question is, what can I do with this F? So the other Maxwell equations. So I've got my object F. And I'd like to make an equation out of these. Okay, I'd like to make four equations, to be specific. And what am I going to do with this? You see, I have to take derivative of this guy. But if I use one of these indices, if I, for example, do this, I'm just recovering that equation, which I already have. So I've got to do something else. Oops, d gamma. So how many equations there? Quite a lot, right? Because this guy has six indices. There are six independent components of the antisymmetric matrix. 6 × 4 = 24. Now I have 24 equations. Too many, okay? So I've got to reduce the number of equations. So what we do is just use symmetry like we did before. And so what we do is actually write this equation. D beta F gamma alpha plus d alpha f beta gamma equals 0. So it looks like a strange thing to do. All I've done, you see, is to cycle these indices. I hope I did it right. So I just move the beta index to the front, move gamma to number 2, and move alpha to position 3. Okay, so I move beta there, gamma to there, and alpha to there. And then I just did the same thing again. I moved alpha to the front, beta to there, gamma to there. And that's the equation. Now the question is, why are there only four components of this equation? Okay? And the reason is that actually this equation is completely equivalent to the following equation. Epsilon alpha beta gamma delta d beta f gamma delta equals 0. Okay, so let me explain. Actually, can you see here? Maybe I have to go or raise it a bit. Is it visible? Tell me if it's not visible. It's okay. So my claim is that these two equations are completely equivalent. And this one is obviously only four equations because I've summed all these indices, right? So this has no indices. Beta, gamma, and delta are all summed. The only free index is the alpha. Why are those two things equivalent? Well, the reason they're equivalent is that this equation, this quantity here on the left, is actually totally antisymmetric. It's not obvious, but this is totally antisymmetric. Okay, what does that mean? To be totally antisymmetric, if I've got some three-component object and it's totally antisymmetric, it means that if I flip any two indices, I get a minus sign. So this is equal to minus b beta alpha gamma. It's equal to minus b alpha gamma beta if I flip those two or those two, etc. Now, if something is totally antisymmetric, oh, so why is it totally antisymmetric? The reason is, let's just do an example. So imagine I flip alpha and beta. Well, this term obviously is antisymmetric. If I flip alpha and beta, this derivative is d alpha, and that's f gamma beta, right? And here I have d beta f alpha gamma. But f gamma alpha, gamma beta, let's just do it, okay? So d alpha f gamma beta plus d beta f alpha gamma. So I just flipped beta with alpha. But you see, f gamma beta is minus f beta gamma. And f alpha gamma is minus f gamma alpha. So this quantity is exactly minus that quantity. So this quantity with these three indices is actually completely antisymmetric. And you could do the same on any of the other, any other pair of indices. And if something is completely antisymmetric, then you really don't lose anything by multiplying by epsilon, because epsilon is totally antisymmetric. Okay? And when I contract it, all I'm doing is I don't lose anything, because let me leave it at that. And so this epsilon alpha beta gamma delta, just like the three-dimensional epsilon, is defined to be plus one if alpha beta gamma delta is an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3, and minus one if it's an odd permutation and zero otherwise. Okay, so then I will just leave it as another exercise to show that in fact this equation or that equation, which is equivalent, are completely equivalent. There are only four of them, and they're completely equivalent to Maxwell's second and third equation. Show this equation, or these four equations, are Maxwell's third and fourth equations. Let's kind of anticipate how that works. Maybe easier to use this form. In this form, we can take alpha equal to 0. And then this is just 0. And the only non-zero component here will be if this is some permutation of 1, 2, 3. So basically, this will give epsilon ijk d I fjk equals 0. Okay, but epsilon ijk fjk is just going to be the b's. And so that's just b, and so that equation is div b equals 0. Okay, so the zero component is just the zero component is div b equals zero. And the I component, if I have an I here, I must have a zero jk. And this will be d0 of something. So there's your d by dt. F jk will give the b. So this is db dt. And the other piece where this is a j will give you the curl e. So there we have it, that Maxwell's eight equations are equivalent to these two four-component equations. So the final thing I want to introduce today is the vector potential. Just to complete the description of electricity and magnetism. So the vector potential, so we recall in electricity and magnetism, it's useful to write E equals minus the gradient of phi, and phi is the electrostatic potential, and B as the curl of A. Okay, so frequently when you solve problems in electromagnetism, it's useful to introduce electrostatic potential instead of the electric field, and a magnetic vector potential instead of the, so this is the electrostatic potential, and this is the magnetic vector potential. And it's very natural in this four-dimensional picture to introduce a four-vector potential. A mu, which and again, the only thing to worry about really is that the quantities going into this four vector have the same dimensions. And remember, B has dimensions of E over C. They have the same dimensions. And so since the gradients both have the same dimensions, phi over C and A have the same dimensions. So we just combine them like that. And we write A downstairs. So when you lower an index, it means multiply by eta, eta mu nu A nu. And the only change you introduce is that the zero component gets an extra minus sign. Minus phi over C A. And now we write the following. F mu nu is d mu A nu minus d nu A mu. So F is an antisymmetric tensor. And so if F is composed of derivatives of A, this is the obvious way to do it. Just anti-symmetrize the derivative of A. And what you find from this is that F0i is equal to D0ai minus DiA0. And from this, we find E equals minus grad phi minus d by dt of A. And that's the correct formula for the electric field. Oops, that's the correct formula for the electric field in the presence of a vector potential. And F dij is diaj minus djai. And so B is equal to curl A. And so you see, I had this formula for F in terms of B, but I can write B in terms of F. Bi is equal to 1/2 epsilon ijk fjk. Let's just check that formula. You see, if I is z, or 3 here, B3, I have epsilon 3, 1, 2, F1, 2, but then I have 3, 2, 1, F2, 1. And F2, 1 is minus F1, 2, so this will give B3 equals F1, 2, and that's correct. Again, you can check the other components. So this is another formula for B. So B is epsilon F, and so from here I get Bi is 1/2 epsilon ijk djak minus dkaj. But these two terms are equal because epsilon is antisymmetric. So if I relabel k with j and j with k, then flip the k with j, I just get the same formula again. Jk djak, which is, so B is curl A. Okay, so we've managed to recover everything about electromagnetism by writing it in this four-component notation. As I emphasize, we haven't done anything except to make the equations look more compact. But once we have them in this form, they are what we call covariant. You see, basically now I can do a symmetry operation which acts on those indices, and then it will just be obvious that by performing the symmetry operation, the equations are invariant. So once you have Maxwell's equations in this form, it's obvious they're Lorentz invariant. The symmetry will be Lorentz transformations, and that's the origin of relativity. Okay, are there any questions? Everything clear? So I'm not sure if there's an examples class this afternoon, or there is?
Yeah.
So perhaps I will just leave you in the examples class to work through all the problems I've given in the lectures. Make sure you really understand all of this. And those of you with different backgrounds, figure out which parts you know, which parts you don't. And that's all we'll do for today. What time is the class? Two 2:15 or 2:30?
It's at 3.
It's at 3. Okay. So I will come by around 3 as well, just to see if I can shed any light. So see you later.